Hi, Allison.
Hi, Max.
What's wrong?
Oh, traffic was terrible getting here.
Oh, no.
And music on the radio is awful. I was so bored.
Oh, no.
I just wish that I had a new podcast to listen to.
Well, guess what?
What?
If you were a contributor on the Patreon at the $5 level, you get the podcast a day early.
What?
Yeah,
a day early?
A whole day early just for being a contributor as our way of saying thank you.
That's the best way to start your week.
Yes, ma'am. You can get that at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Thanks. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Welcome to
The Bitchery of History. My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking about Nirja Bhanot.
Ooh, yes. I'm going to be talking about Empress Himiko.
Oh.
Get ready.
You know I love them ancient Asian queens.
Get it.
Love. All right, so Nirja Bhanot is a true hero in every sense of the word.
Ooh. All right. All
so
right.
She was born September 7th, 1963 in Chandigarh, India, and was brought up in Mumbai in a Punjabi family. Her parents were Harish Bhanot, a Mumbai-based journalist who wrote for the Hindustan Times, and Rama Bhanot. And she had two older brothers as well, Akhil and Anish Bhanot. Mm. She went to Sacred Heart Senior Secondary School for early schooling in Chandigarh, when her family moved to Bombay, which we currently know as Mumbai. Mm. She continued studies at Bombay Scottish School and graduated from St. Xavier's College in Mumbai.
She really went to Xavier's School.
In Mumbai, she was first spotted for a modeling assignment, and her modeling career began. Hmm. She appeared in commercials and advertisements for companies like Benzir Saris, Bianca Toothpaste, Godrej Besto Detergent, Vaporex, and Vico Turmeric Cream.
It's only going to be a matter of time until turmeric cream is sold in Whole Foods. I guarantee
absolutely.
It.
Yeah, if it's not already, they're developing it now. In 1985, Pan Am, the airline, decided to have an all-Indian cabin crew for its first flight from Frankfurt to India. And she was selected, and she went to Miami, Florida to be trained as a flight attendant, but returned as something called a purser. And now a purser is a special term for a chief flight attendant, or the cabin manager, essentially, the one who looked over all the other flight attendants. And they were also in charge of making sure that the passengers were safe and comfortable above all of the other flight attendants that are happening. They also created detailed reports and verified safety procedures were being followed. So she actually had this really, she went away to become a flight attendant and she came back as something more.
Ooh.
On September 5th, 1986, Nirja was a senior flight purser on Pan Am Flight 73, which was flying from Mumbai to the U.S. And the plane was hijacked by four armed men at Karachi Airport in Pakistan while the plane was still on the tarmac. The four gunmen sped onto the tarmac in a van disguised as airport security and fired shots in the air upon entering the plane. The plane had 361 passengers and 14 crew members aboard.
Oh my God.
Yeah, not good. The terrorists wanted to fly to Cyprus and then Israel with the goal of freeing Palestinian prisoners there. Mm. It was also reported that they wanted to fly the plane into a building in Israel.
Oof.
As the senior-most cabin crew member, Nirja took charge of the situation inside the plane. One of the flight attendants, Shireen Pavan, was out of sight of the gunmen, and upon hearing the shots, reached for the intercom and pressed the emergency number on the cockpit. The pilot picked up, and she relayed the hijack code that they had at the time. And since the plane was still on the tarmac, the three-member cockpit crew, the pilot, the co-pilot, and the flight engineer, were able to escape through an overhead hatch inside the cockpit itself.
Wow.
So there was actually some criticism after the fact of the pilots for leaving their crew. But there's one of the surviving flight attendants on the flight said her name was Sunshine Vesuala.
Mm-hmm.
Later said, I was relieved when I saw the pilots were gone, as we were all safer on the ground than we would be in the air.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in any case, at least the three pilots were safe. Three lives were saved.
Right.
The hijackers were part of the Abu Nidal organization, which was a terrorist group that was actually backed by the country of Libya. They were targeting Americans and American assets. And this is where Nirja's heroism really comes in.
Okay.
Early on in the hijacking, they were able to identify an American citizen. And when no pilot came to fly the plane after 1 hour, they shot him in the head and threw his body on the tarmac.
Oh, my God.
After 4 hours, they instructed Nirja to collect the passports of all the passengers so that they could identify the other Americans on board. She and the other attendants hid the passport of the 41 Americans on board, some under seats, the rest in the trash cans.
Wow.
Yeah. After 17 hours, the plane's backup generator turned off, and they were all plunged into darkness. And it was then that the hijackers opened fire and set off explosives in the plane.
Ugh.
In the chaos, Nirja opened one of the airplane doors and started helping the passengers escape. Two other doors had been opened, but they didn't have the inflatable slides. Yeah. And at least two people actually fractured bones jumping out of the plane onto the tarmac.
Yeah.
According to one surviving passenger, quote, she was guiding the passengers to the emergency exit. That is when the terrorists were firing constantly, fearing a commando attack. They saw Nirja relentlessly trying to help the passengers out, and that is when they caught her by the ponytail and shot her at point blank. She was shot while shielding three American children from gunfire.
Oh my God.
Out of 41 American passengers on board, 22 were killed. And two crew members as well, including Nirja and a plane mechanic.
Hmm.
In total, 150 people were injured in this one terrorist attack.
Wow.
Internationally, she was recognized as, quote, the heroine of the hijack. She became the youngest recipient and the first woman to receive the Ashok Chakra Award, which is India's most prestigious gallantry award for bravery during peacetime.
Wow.
And then in 2004, the Indian Postal Service released a stamp commemorating her.
Hmm.
She received the Justice for Crimes Award in 2005 as a part of the annual Crime Rights Week in Washington, D.C.
Hmm.
And her brother, Anish, accepted it on her behalf. In 2006, she and other Pan Am Flight 73 flight attendants and the Pan Am Flight Director of Pakistan were awarded the Special Courage Award by the U.S. Department of Justice.
Hmm.
And then on July 2nd, 2016, the Bharat Gaurav Award was conferred on her at a ceremony held at the House of Commons at the UK Parliament in London, England. Her family set up a Nirja Banot Pan Am Trust with the insurance money and a contribution from Pan Am. They present two awards every year, one for a flight crew member worldwide who acts beyond the call of duty, and the other Nirja Banot Award to an Indian woman when faced with social injustice, bravely faced the situation and helped other women in similar social distress. The award includes about $2,000 in American money and a trophy as well.
Wow.
The craziest thing about the whole hijack, and I guess the saddest thing, is that it occurred 2 days before her 23rd birthday.
Holy wow.
Yeah.
I'm speechless.
Yeah. So that's Nirja, an ordinary person who showed up when the time needed her to, and she became a hero.
Are there any movies about her?
There is, actually. In 2016, a biographical film called Nirja was released. It was directed by Ram Madhavani, and it starred Sonam Kapoor.
So it's a Bollywood film, or is it? Yeah.
I think it's just biographical. I don't know.
But like, it's made but it's like it's made in India.
Yes.
Correct. In the United States.
Correct. Yes. But I don't think it's Bollywood in the terms of like the musical numbers and all that stuff.
But made in India.
Correct.
Man, I really want to see it.
I know. We should find it.
Yeah.
Have a movie night.
Okay.
Yes.
Wow. That's incredible. I feel like a lot of times we think we have to look into the very distant past or even the slightly more recent past, you know, a couple hundred years to find these incredible stories of young women doing amazing heroic things. And you really don't have to look that hard.
You don't at all. They're all around us.
But we will travel to the ancient past now.
Yes.
See what I did there. We're going to talk about Empress Himiko. And by the very ancient past, I mean 170 to 248
AD. Oh my God. That's a long
time ago. So, soups long time ago, guys.
Soups long.
Soups long. So, Himiko, who's also known as Pamiko, was a shaman queen in ancient Japan.
Yes.
Ancient Hua.
Mm-hmm.
She took the throne after the country grew tired of decades of warfare under male rule.
There's a common theme here we're seeing for
the theme
ancient female
is,
rulers.
Oh, you guys don't actually all want to die and have all of our food and all of our money and all of our things destroyed.
Right.
But let's just have a woman rule because it's better. What we know about Himiko actually comes from ancient Chinese texts and scholars. She's not mentioned in early Japanese histories at all, but historians have associated her with other legendary figures such as the Empress Consort Jingjue. There have been a lot of debates about the identity of Himiko and the location of her kingdom Yamate since the late Edo period in Japan.
Okay. Yeah.
And one Japanese scholar said that the debate over, you know, if this country existed, if Himiko is a real person, is kind of the greatest debate over the ancient history of Japan.
Oh, okay.
So we have some records, but like some of the women that we've talked about, it's kind of a pick and choose situation. So the first historical records that we have of Himiko are found in Records of Three Kingdoms, which is a classical Chinese text from about 297 AD. Okay. And there's a section in this that is translates to the account of the Wa people, which is what Japan was referred to before it was Japan. And it says the people of Japan dwell in the middle of the ocean on the mountainous islands southeast of Taifeng. They formerly comprised more than 100 communities. During the Han Dynasty, Japanese envoys appeared at the court, and today 30 of their communities maintain intercourse with China through envoys and scribes.
Okay.
So China is aware that Japan exists.
Sure.
They're having this interplay of ideas and all of these things. And this listing or description of Himiko makes her apparently the first named male or female figure in Japanese history ever.
That's so cool.
Ever of all time. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
That's really cool. That's really, especially for such a male dominated culture. Absolutely.
Yeah. First person you ever know about for sure from Japan.
Cool. That's
is an empress.
Yeah,
it's
great.
So awesome.
Yeah.
Like we do a lot of firsts on the podcast. That's a pretty incredible
first.
Yeah,
that's amazing, especially for a culture that not only is so male, but also is so ancient as Japanese culture is.
Absolutely. So in this text, they describe the Chinese authors, historians describe the rise of Himiko saying that they had a man for a ruler, but after 70 or 80 years of, quote, disturbances and warfare, end quote, the people agreed to have a woman for their ruler. She was apparently only 14 when she ascended the throne.
That's
and according to, according to Chinese text, she occupied herself with magic and sorcery, bewitching people. One text claims that this is how she gained the power of the throne, through sorcery.
Right.
She remained unmarried, and her younger brother assisted her in ruling the country. And apparently very few people saw her after she became ruler, but she reportedly had 1,000 women attendants and only one man who served her food and drink and acted as a medium of communication. She lived in a palace surrounded by towers and with many armed guards at all times. In the Chinese English translation, Records of Wei, it is stated that the Yamate Kingdom was the strongest of the 30 countries in Japan that China had contact with. So there are a lot of accounts of envoys traveling between the ancient Japanese and Chinese courts. But Himiko's emissaries first visited the emperor in 238, the Chinese emperor, and he said of her, quote, "We now officially call you, Himiko, a friend of Wei. We expect you, O queen, to rule your people in peace and to endeavor to be devoted and obedient." So they then gave her as a gift a golden seal and 100 ceremonial bronze mirrors, which was a huge status symbol at this
time.
So the kingdom allegedly prospered under the empress's rule and was observed to have more than 70,000 households, well-organized laws, taxation systems, and thriving trade. The people were noted to be gentle and peace-loving. During her reign, the empress reportedly sent envoys to other countries to try and limit the influence of these rival rulers.
Okay, yeah. Just kind of to mitigate things
exactly
before things happen.
Right. Just like, be cool, bro. Right. We cool, you cool.
I see you, you see me.
Everything good. Everything's good. By 247, Empress Himiko's kingdom and the country of Kuna were at odds, but the outcome of the conflict is unknown. It's only known that she wanted Chinese imperial support and then likely died in the year after that.
Dang.
So she lived between about 138 to 248 AD without having ever married.
138
to
148?
To 248. So remember.
So like 110 years or something like that.
No.
138 to 248.
183 to 248.
I heard 138.
Oh, yeah. No.
Okay.
Wow, that would be an amazing story, though. That's like the Moses of Japan.
Exactly.
So, these ancient Chinese authors writing in their records of Wei report, quote, when Himiko passed away, a great mound was raised more than 100 paces in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
Over 100 male and female attendants followed her to the grave. Then a king was placed on the throne, but the people would not obey him.
Followed her to the grave like they were buried with her?
Yeah, they did that in ancient Egypt too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So assassination and murder followed. More than 1,000 were thus slain.
Oh my God.
A relative of Himiko named Lyo, a girl of 13, was then made queen and order was restored. Just always have queens. Dear everyone, just always have queens. You'll be cool.
When your mom goes away and your dad's in charge and everything just goes crazy.
Yeah, pretty much. So the Great Mound, likely referring to a kofun or a big pile of dirt that's shaped like a keyhole. They were consecrated as mausoleums for deceased rulers. And there have been over 5,200 identified so far throughout the Kyoto, Osaka, Nara region.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons that the third century in Japan is referred to as the Kofun period, because they're everywhere.
Oh, okay.
Between 1955 and 1964, there were a series of archaeological discoveries that reignited the debate about the location of Empress Himiko's original kingdom and then where she was buried. But one of these discoveries was the excavation of a tomb near Kyoto that had numerous bronze mirrors inside, possibly dating from the third century. So pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah.
There are several cities in Japan that claim Himiko as a town mascot, and there are statues of her in several places all over because, again, it's not really for sure where she was living.
Mm-hmm.
But despite the debate over her existence and her lack of existence in Japanese historical texts, about 99% of Japanese school children recognize and can identify her.
Oh, cool.
Now, what's even more fascinating about Himiko is that she wasn't exactly unique for her time. Before the importation of Chinese, Buddhist, and Confucian ideology, women held much higher positions of leadership in Japan.
Yeah. I think we've talked a little bit about in the past how China used Confucianism as the model for their government. And Confucianism has very, very rigidly set gender roles because they believe Confucianism is all about yin and yang.
Right.
And men are suited to do one thing and women are suited to do another thing.
It's all right. It's not like Christianity is great to their women either.
Well, yeah. No one really has been.
Well,
yeah.
I think Wicca is good to women.
True. Yeah. I think nowadays.
The Wiccans were good.
The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can start your free trial and get a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery. This week, I'm going to recommend just a whole series of books.
Yes.
Nancy Drew.
Yes,
because we haven't talked about it. If you get them on Audible, they're narrated by Laura Linney. So even though it's a little bit dated, there are actually some modern day updates of Nancy Drew's stories. So, you know, you have a little less sexism. But even for her time, Nancy is such a go-getter and always the hero of her own story. And she always has to rescue her boyfriend, Ned, because he can't do anything on his own. And you just get to listen to Laura Linney read you a bedtime story.
I love Laura Linney.
Why do you not want that to be a thing? You do. So go to audibletrial.com/bitchery and check it out.
Yes, ma'am. Hey, everybody. If you're enjoying the podcast, if you're enjoying The Bitchery of History, do Allison and myself a favor and go look at the phone or computer you're listening to this podcast on and give us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks. Today in history?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
On May 1st, 1987, Edith Stein, a Jewish-born Carmelite nun who died at Auschwitz, was beatified in the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes. And then on May 2nd, 1250, Shajar al-Durr became the Sultana of Egypt, a former woman of the week.
Also on May 2nd, 1999, Maria Moscoso becomes the first woman elected president of Panama.
Yes.
Go, girl.
All right. So I was thinking this week, we would talk about radical feminism.
Let's talk about it.
And I think we should, the most important thing we need to get out of this conversation is a definition of what it is.
Yes.
And what it's not.
Yes.
So
let me hear it. Lay it out for me.
So radical feminism is a perspective within feminism, mm-hmm. right? That calls for a radical reordering of society in which male supremacy is eliminated from all social and economic contexts. Radical feminists seek to abolish patriarchy by challenging existing social norms and institutions rather than through a purely political process.
Mm.
So let's say what it's not. It is not for bringing down men.
It is not for burning bras.
It is not for demeaning anybody or anything. It's simply an idea within feminism mm-hmm. that says, look, the political process you are asking us to change what we want to change in is inherently patriarchal. And so to a certain extent, there is an amount of change that will not be possible unless we physically change the political process itself.
They're not wrong.
They're not wrong.
You're not wrong.
It's like talking about systemic racism, talking mm-hmm. about systemic queer issues, talking about systemic issues that affect any subsect of the human species that we all belong to.
I think that's important because feminism already has the reputation to be this crazy radical idea mm-hmm. when really it's just the notion that women are people.
Exactly.
And we would like to be respected
exactly.
as people.
And as equals.
As equals. There's a great meme that floats around every now and then. Mm-hmm. And it says something along the lines of, don't teach your sons to respect women because they have mothers yes. and sisters and aunts and wives.
Right.
Teach them to respect women because women are people.
Exactly.
You shouldn't need an example of like, would you say that to your mom? Would you say that to another human?
Exactly. Because that argument then becomes, don't respect the woman because she's a woman. Respect her because of her ties to other men. Respect her because she is. Here's a good example.
Mm-hmm.
In the Constitution, it says all men are created equal. And then we had to go on and put in the 19th Amendment
right.
to guarantee women the right to vote.
Right.
There's nothing in the Constitution that says women can't have the right to vote.
Right.
It was just built into society as a cultural thing.
Right.
We talk about the Equal Rights Amendment. We've talked mm-hmm. about that
yeah.
in previous episodes. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that women aren't equal to men, but we have to put in the Equal Rights Amendment anyways.
Right.
Because the structure of our society and the structure of that document was created in an era where the ERA was necessary. It becomes necessary because right. of how it was created and crafted in the first place.
Exactly. So sometimes a building is too full of mold. It's unsalvageable and yeah. you just have to burn it to the ground and yep. build a new building.
Yep. So next time someone calls you a radical feminist, what are you going to say?
Thank you. Yeah. Or you're not wrong.
Yeah.
Our cause for this week or our organization is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yes, I love them. They partner with organizations around the world to tackle critical problems in four program areas. In Global Development Division, Global Health Division, United States Division, and then Global Policy and Advocacy Division. And they honestly do a ton of work all over the world. And you can find them at gatesfoundation.org.
I just want to share this really cool thing that I saw as a quote uh-huh. from Bill Gates, because someone was asking him, you know, you're known as one of the greatest philanthropists ever. And he right. said, well, yeah, but I'm pretty rich. So, you know, what I do is great and wonderful. But comparatively, somebody who's donating even just a little bit
yes.
that's less financially well off than me is probably a better philanthropist because they're making more of a sacrifice. So even if you only have a little bit to donate, or even if it's just your time volunteering at a local yes. shelter, I definitely urge you to become a part of the world around you.
That's,
make it a better place.
That's such a good point to make. At a certain point, money can only do so much
mm-hmm.
and you need bodies on the ground. So mm-hmm. that's a really great point to make.
Well, I'm a woman. I know how to run a peaceful society. What can I say? The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, all at UMPBOH. That's facebook.com/UMPBOH and at UMPBOH on the other social media sites. We also have an amazing new website up. That's UMPBOH.com. Thank you, Sydney.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Sydney. You can also find us and help us make the podcast happen at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. Guys, we're going to have some very exciting stuff on there, so become part of the process. We'd like to give a shout out to our production team.
Jeanette.
Kim.
Stephanie.
Ashley.
Dan.
And Olivia.
And Kim. Did we say that? Did we say Kim already?
Kim twice. Maybe.
As always, bitches get stuff done.